This is The Conversation. It's episode 170 with Adrienne Herman. She is a Maine-based artist. That's Maine, M-A-I-N-E, based artist and professor at the Maine College of Art in Portland, Maine, a.k.a. Mecca. She has also spent a lot of time in Kansas City, which is an area of the country that we also have not covered. So I'm excited to bring into the fold some new locales, mix things up a bit from just New York and occasionally LA. And for those of you who are in Kansas City or the Midwest, elsewhere, I haven't heard much from you guys. So you guys are a particularly quiet bunch. So I'm hoping that with this conversation with Adrienne, we will get a little dialogue going with you in particular in Kansas City and generally in the Midwest. That would be great. And I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see quite an amazing assortment of images that Adrienne has provided me, including a quite regal cow amidst quite an array of debris / trash. Images from her series, The Freeing Throwers, and a couple that with titles that kind of speak for themselves. All This Baggage is for the Birds, Surrendering Something from the Superfluous to the Sisyphean. You can also see a few images from her recent series, Wreckage Salad, which is based on one of these giant compost piles that she has photographed quite a bit. People throwing their, what they are trying to let go, what they are letting go into the compost pile. And we do talk a lot about letting go. So that's one of the themes. And that's not only in the literal sense, but in the figurative sense as well, as you will hear. Yeah, so happy to get a couple new locales on the podcast. And before we jump in, wanted to let you know that on the back end, you will be getting some great bad advice that will take you through the holidays and beyond. And finally, before we get into this conversation, I just have sort of an art review wake-up pick for the week. I occasionally catch quotable things that catch my attention, and this was definitely one. It is from The New Yorker, which I am a devoted reader of, in their art encapsulation section towards the beginning of the magazine. This is from a review of a show of Jim Hodges, and this is how the short review ends. You can catch your reflection in some of the panels, but put down your phone and take it all in. Hodges's glass box is less spectacular than salutary, a therapeutic intermission in an art world that sometimes seems to have forgotten the power of form. Let's just take that in for a second. Because indeed, if there's anything you can say about the art world, it is completely devoid of formalism. Isn't it? Such a crisis in the lack of form that we have going on in the art world right now. For those of you in Miami, I'm sure you are absolutely bereft at the dearth of form on hand in those commercial boxes, right? All right. I think you get the message. That's sarcasm. Come on in anytime. Now let's go listen to my conversation with Adrienne. And I will talk to you more on the back end. Thank you very much for being here. So you are in Maine. You're my first Maine guest. Where? What part of Maine are you in right now?
Right now I'm in Yarmouth, which is just north of Portland. I live a little south of Portland, but I'm up in Yarmouth to use this landline.
Right. Oh, well, thank you for making the commute. and how long have you been in Maine now?
I moved here in August of 2002, so what is that, a little over 14 years?
Right. So at what point does one consider themselves a Mainer?
Well, you can consider yourself a Mainer all you want, but Mainers won't consider you a Mainer
right.
ever, if you come from Cotoway. But,
right.
Yeah, I do. It does feel like home now, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I consider myself a Mainer.
Right, okay. And you were drawn there to go teach at the school, at the university, correct? Or at the art school? What is it, an art school or a university?
It's a small art college called Maine College of Art.
Yeah. Okay, got it. And what is its, for myself and people listening, can you give us a brief primer on what its reputation is, particularly what it was, you know, before you got there, since now you probably have more of an insider's take?
Well, interesting question. I think Maine College of Art, or Mecca, as it's known for short, it's not
the
really
Mecca of Maine.
Mecca, right. it's interesting. I think its reputation probably when I was interviewing, frankly, I hadn't heard of the college before I saw the job listing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was maybe more regionally known, but mm-hmm. it is small and intimately scaled as it is. There's a lot of one-on-one attention for students, and it came from a traditional school. It was called, I think, Portland School of Art,
mm-hmm.
probably very representational-based early on, painting and drawing, sculpture. And I think when I moved here, it had just kind of gotten into more digital imaging. They started a new media program. I was hired to come in and teach both in printmaking and in what was then called new media and now has another name.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ask me what drew me here or just the reputation of the school?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to give, myself and people listening a sense of right. Yeah, I mean, I think you've outlined that the Portland, which is so Portland, fed into Maine College of Art.
Yeah. Yes. Definitely. I mean, Maine College of Art is right downtown on kind of the main drag called Congress Street, and as a result of that, actually, they moved into this old department store building, this five-story. Really quite nice building that had been empty. And in a certain sense, Mecca and I think also L.L. Bean at the time started an outlet store nearby. It was kind of credited somewhat with revitalizing the downtown area,
mm-hmm.
which had struggled financially when that department store tried to survive and kind of move out by the mall. And, you know, there was that kind of, exodus from downtown areas. And Portland struggled a lot financially, I think, in the 70s and 80s. And so one of the things that drew me here was that the school is right in the heart of downtown. And so, and there's like a big, you know, lobby with big plate glass windows. And so I was drawn to that kind of permeable membrane where students could put work in the lobby,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, just walk out on the sidewalk and be kind of presenting or exhibiting work. And, that kind of integration in the city was really interesting to me.
Right.
Both as a teacher and an artist.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about the school and the students who go there is taking me back to the conversation that I had with Michelle Grabner, and the conversations that, or the way that she described the students she's worked with over the years in Chicago, and sort of the main decisions, main, no pun intended, decisions that they have of, you know, going to the big cities, you know, after they finish, or maybe going to a more modest-sized city, you know, and depending on budget, ambition, but also strategy, because it's right. Not as simple as, oh, you just go to New York, you know. So what has been your experience over the years with your students, what they do when they finish? And by the way, just to clarify, is there a graduate program at Mecca, or is it both undergrad and graduate, or how does that work?
Yeah, there is, and actually I'm currently teaching more. I'm two-thirds in the grad program.
Mm-hmm.
And one-third in the BFA program, and it was for years, it was one of the first low residency programs, and that's how I entered it at first, but now we have a full residency and a low residency path through the program.
Mm-hmm.
And we work a lot in the summer to take advantage of, I guess, you know, sort of being in Maine. We bring in visiting artists like Michelle Grabner.
Okay.
We brought her in when I was interim director in 2006, and
right.
She's actually been very influential on me. I was exposed to her when I was a grad student in Madison, and
mm-hmm.
have followed her career and been really inspired by her. So I sort of consider myself one of her students, even though I wasn't officially one.
Right.
So I mean, our program also, especially the low residency track, is a lot of one-on-one interaction, and so I do get to know my students quite well, and I do follow their careers. And you know, quite a few of them have stayed in Portland, and they do go, you know, they go out and they do everything. Do you want some examples or just sort of a general?
Yeah, no, I mean, let me just interject this way. I can see, based on your mention of Michelle Grabner and obviously a lot of other big name visiting artists that come through, that when you're at the school, you probably, you know, you have all the advantages that, or a lot of the advantages that big city, you know, art schools have in that sense. But I guess I wonder what your typical, how would you describe your typical, if there is such a thing, you know, Mecca student, as far as, you know, they're from the Maine or upper New England area, then they go to the art school, and then what happens to them generally at that point after they finish?
I think that the undergrad students do tend to be from New England, quite a few from Maine and New Hampshire, but also Massachusetts. I don't know if this is still true, but some years ago I was told that a fairly large percentage of our students are first-generation college.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a really high percentage of graduates who continue to practice continue to make art, and which, you know, it's just something the school is proud of, and I think it makes sense because, I think in general artists, people who are drawn to art schools are already know they're artists, and so they're probably going to make regardless. But because maybe they don't in as much, I would say Mecca students don't move to New York or LA or Chicago in droves. That probably influences the fact that if they do stay in, say, a more affordable place, they can, you know, they don't have to hold down as many jobs to pay for an apartment. Although it is expensive to live here, and increasingly there's actually been quite an exodus of artists out of certain neighborhoods in Portland that had been filled with artists and very advantageous to artists in a lot of ways. So there's a huge real estate boom going on, and there's actually kind of a housing crisis. And so some students actually end up sort of having to leave Portland, or at least the sort of the mainland, so to speak. The graduate student profile is probably somewhat different, especially the low residency students, because you really only need to be here in the summer for 8 weeks, and then in the winter for a week, and then when you're hanging your MFA show, or installing your thesis show, you need to be here for another week to defend the thesis, and as a result, you can keep a full-time job. You can have a family. You can have kids. You could live anywhere in the world. You could live in any country, and we'll hook you up with a one-on-one mentor.
Mm-hmm.
So that attracts students from all over, which is pretty exciting. And we do, as you say, get really exciting, stimulating visiting artists in the summer. And because they're here, usually they don't have other business in Portland. They're sort of captive, and so We work them very hard. They do a lot of studio visits, and they come to events, and a number of them do studio visits with other people in town, and just kind of immerse themselves in Portland maybe more than they would if they were, say, New York artists doing a visiting artist gig in New York, where they would have a lot of business. So there is that. Our students do get a lot of access to the visiting artists.
Well, going back to, and this kind of goes back to the beginning of my asking about, you know, what it's like up there, it's a little disconcerting that, you know, Portland, which I don't know what people's perception of it is, but that, as you describe, it's a less and less affordable place for artists to live. Is the trend that you're seeing that people are moving to outlying areas of Portland, suburbs, if you will, or are they going even sort of further afield because even the suburbs are not really that affordable?
I think the suburbs are still affordable. I mean, and it's funny, we don't really think of them as suburbs.
Right.
You don't use that term as much around here.
Sure.
But yes, I think the sort of the outlying areas, there's been a kind of influx of artists in an area called Saco in Biddeford, which has a lot of old mill buildings, and you know, now new restaurants and galleries and a lot of ferment. You know, I think it's fairly typical cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's probably not, it's disconcerting and it's challenging and it certainly churns people up, but it, you know, it may not be a quote unquote bad thing. It's just, and it may be bringing in, one of the things Portland hasn't had as much of is, you know, galleries of that are showing art that isn't necessarily representational or might not appeal to people who are here on vacation.
Right.
And so there haven't been there have been sort of few and far between galleries of that type, and there are some really new exciting ones. There's a new gallery called Abel Baker that was just started by two artists, and there's just I noticed down I dropped something to be framed the other day on in this kind of industrial area. And I noticed a Persian rug store, and there's all these breweries, and you know, there's a lot of that sort of thing happening. And so, you know, there it might be the case that you know, maybe some of that might trickle down, or there might be more. It might be beneficial for artists because it is somewhat hard scrabble here to be an artist, and in terms of jobs and salary levels and. You know, just a market to sell work is has not been that
vibrant
in my experience anyway.
Is Abel Baker going to be at all commercial, or is it more of an artist run, you know, opportunity for our local artists to show kind of situation?
It is a commercial gallery for sure, and it's artist run and it is creating opportunities. So it's sort of all of the above. There's another space called Space Gallery, which is a nonprofit space and has. You know, brought in many, many, many great shows and musicians and performances and films over the years. So that's kind of a cultural hub, and it's two doors down from Mecca, the college. So really, and Abel Baker is just a few blocks away. So there really is this kind of, I don't know, kind of tight area of, you know, good stuff. It's a small number, but but it's active and it's rich, and there's always more stuff to go, you know, to go to than you can possibly do. So
right. And going back to the gentrification issue, for lack of a better word, are you renting? Do you own? What is your situation?
I do actually own a small house a little bit south of Portland, and I used to own a house a while back, and then I. Spent a period of time. I think I moved like 8 times in 3 years or something. So I have been through a lot of different apartments and in all different areas of Portland and Yarmouth and Cape Elizabeth and South Portland and Peaks Island. So I was, you know, sort of experienced that recent, I guess, renter's market. And,
right.
And I have a dog, and so it became difficult to just negotiate that. And so I bought this. Yard and it came with a small house.
You bought a yard that came with a small house. That's great. It's
yeah,
a good deal.
Yeah.
What was your favorite neighborhood of all those 8 different places that you lived in over a short time?
Oh my gosh.
Cape Elizabeth sounds the most glamorous, but I mean, is it?
it's very beautiful. There are a lot of really great places to walk and scenic overlooks and places to swim, and my dog really loves that. My dog would say Cape Elizabeth is the best. I would say I really enjoyed living in the West End of Portland. I could walk to work and, you know, just saw people. And there was, I don't know, like walking by the barber shop and having my dog, like, you know, run into the barber shop and having him say hello. Like just stuff like that. It felt sort of like small town. That was, you know, a short period of time for me. And it was difficult just in terms of my dog and parking and so it depends on what your criteria are in terms of like ease of living or, you know, having a space big enough where you can work as an artist. Right now I have a studio downtown above Space Gallery, so I kind of have both.
That's worlds your studio above Space Gallery?
Yes. I rent one of their studios.
Oh, so they're your landlord?
They are my landlord, yeah. I used to have my studio in my home, but now I've had that studio for some maybe 4 years, 3 or 4 years now. And it's a great community. And one of the things that they do is, you know, open studios and,
right.
And, you know, that's, you know, obviously a great way to just bring in audience and have people see one's work and be witnessed. And, you know, something that I'm dealing with a lot in my work right now is the power of witnessing and the power of being received and being reflected back. And so it's nice to not always have to make the effort, you know, to mail things out and gather tons of people together, but there are these kinds of events that I can just sort of take advantage of other people's
right.
PR prowess.
Yeah.
Have this stream of people moving through has been really exciting.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because that kind of merges nicely with what I was thinking about getting into next, which is back to the original line of thought, which is that you are, you know, an artist in Maine. If I remember from our earlier conversation, you are originally from Connecticut, so you're, you know, from the Northeast. And you were in New York, correct, at one point?
Yeah. I was born in New York. I grew up mostly in Connecticut, and then went to college in Massachusetts, and then moved back to New York between a post-college internship I did in D.C. for a year at a museum, and then I moved back to New York and worked, and then went to grad school in Madison.
So you've been all over.
And then I was in Kansas City teaching at the Art Institute there for 5 years before
right.
I came here.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get at your perception of
my New England roots.
Yeah, well, also like being an artist, you know, outside an art center, and you know, because you were in New York for a period, even if not a very long one, you know, maybe it's kind of been what you're used to because you were in Milwaukee. You said Milwaukee, was it?
Madison.
Sorry, you were in Madison. You were in Kansas City, so you were in the Midwest.
Yeah.
You were in the Northeast.
Absolutely.
Right. You know,
yeah.
I mean, so that has been kind of your comfort zone, maybe? I don't know if that's the right expression, but how would you put it?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I do feel very comfortable in New York, and I love being there. But when I'm there, I'm gorging. You know, it's like, I mean, for me now, when I lived there, I looked at a lot of art, but I also had a job. And I guess I left there because I felt like it would be, I really wanted that grad school experience where I was really immersed in my work, and I didn't want to be tempted to keep my job. And things in New York, just, you know, like even just getting a piece of plywood in New York, it just felt like, you know, kind of a Herculean effort. And so
right.
I thought, you know, I want to go somewhere I can, like, you know, have an old car and get a parking space and just really focus on my work.
Right.
I mean, I think that is an interesting point. I mean, I have been away from New York since 1993, and Kansas City definitely had that mentality of, you know, it wasn't one of the centralized art capitals, although I think probably Kansas City far more than Portland, Maine. And Kansas City had incredible resources for artists and a lot of venues and affordable housing and a lot of collectors and a lot of corporations. There was, like, just stuff that you wouldn't really know that was there unless you lived there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Portland, you know, I was excited to move here partly because I can drive to New York, you know, and I have driven to New York for a lecture and come back the same day. It's not ideal, but I do
right.
that kind of thing.
Right.
And I can go and see shows. It's much more likely that I'll see shows that are important to me now that I live in Maine. But
yeah, and speaking of going back to Kansas City, because when we spoke last time, you really portrayed of an idyllic, you know, art community, and I can totally see just the simple reality of getting a good teaching job and going to Maine. But to what extent did you have mixed feelings about it, or did you think, you know, this sucks, I'm going to be leaving this behind?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I didn't realize how hard it would be to replicate what I had in Kansas City. I had a great job there. I had a tremendous community.
What was your job?
I guess at that point I was an assistant professor of printmaking. I was program head of printmaking at Kansas City Art Institute, which attracts really, really good students regionally, I think, in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it attracts students who are incredibly committed artists, and I felt like often, honestly, I felt like I was studying with my students. They were like, you know, many of them have gone on to just have these incredible careers, and you know, they were. I don't know if it was like I always. Sometimes I think, oh, that was just an extraordinary batch, but no, I mean, they're amazing artists, and I've been very inspired by my students in Maine too. But there's something a little bit different, like in Kansas City. It's hard to describe, but it is a large city, and there are a lot of artists, but there's this kind of familiarity and small town feel that. Somehow there are just these hubs like YJ's Cafe where you just go and you see everyone you know and you don't need to like make a date. And, you know, some of it was that it was sort of pre-cell phone when I was there. And, you know, there just wasn't that same kind of, I don't know, like people just standing on the street corners looking at their phones. Like there was a lot more kind of one-on-one direct engagement. And if you started something interesting, like my partner at the time and I, Brian Reeves and I started this space called the Slop Art Shop, and people, like the art critic in Kansas City, called us and said, I heard you're starting a new space. When is your first show, and what will it be called? And, you know, we came from Madison where you know, we're scratching at the door trying to get press and, you know, trying to get attention to this project we were doing that was promoting artists and trying to kind of encourage consumption of fine art and encourage people to buy it and live with it. And so here's this art critic, you know, we sort of just arrived and she's sort of, you know, reaching out and we were, you know, we were kind of flabbergasted by that. And people came and just, you know, embraced us. And so, you know, I had this great job. I had a lot of friends. We had a venue. We had, you know, affordable rent. And then this job, you know, this job came up in Maine and I was inspired by the school, and they had, when I came to visit, there was a William Pope Elle exhibition in the college gallery. And, again, there was just this kind of like real centralized location of the school. And I also, I think, as you know, to go back to your question, I think I did want to get back to New England. I do feel comfortable here. And I think I thought that what we had in Kansas City would translate here. I think I thought, well, you know, we had this great community in Kansas City. We had it in Madison, and it was slower to build that in Portland. And some of that may be like, as you say, we were living in the suburbs. We were in South Portland. My colleagues were, you know, more of them had kids and weren't necessarily running alternative art spaces in their spare time, like the KCAI people were. So there was just less integration and less kind of like lots of activities to just go to all the time. And, you know, and it's cold and you have to shovel your sidewalk and like, there's just like, you know, it's just the realities of living in Maine are a little bit different.
Don't you have to shovel your sidewalk in Kansas City too, or no?
you don't get as much snow, and I don't remember shoveling snow in Kansas City. I do remember cutting my micro lawn with scissors, but and I remember trying to get. I remember once going to seeing a. Not being able to get down my street in Kansas City and seeing a snowplow at, you know, at a Dunkin' Donuts and going in and saying, hey, when are you going to plow that street? And they said, when the snow stops, which I thought was odd. Whereas, you know, in Maine, when we moved here, you know, they plow several times during a storm.
Right.
And Kansas City was kind of, it was a bit more like the Wild West. Like you wouldn't be fined if you didn't plow, or if you didn't shovel your sidewalk or, you know, it's just not part of my memory. But, you know, on the other hand, there are many amazing aspects of being here, just sort of in terms of the physical beauty and being able to go to the water. And, you know, and now I am part of this extraordinary community. It just took longer for me to, it came and found me when I was in Kansas City, and I had to be more proactive and, and just, it was just slower.
Sure.
Just, you know.
Well, I wonder, you know, still, you left Kansas City, as you said, over a decade ago. But what is your sense of how the art community that you described has changed or evolved since then? Or is that something that you kind of aren't that up to date on?
Well, actually, I am rather up to date on Kansas City.
Good.
pardon the pun or song reference. because I did do, I had a residency in Kansas City from fall 2014. To summer 2015, I went out there and I needed a break from teaching and sort of being in charge of anything. And and I, at the time, I was just finishing 10 years of work collecting people's to-do lists and grocery lists and kind of re-presenting those through different, you know, some of them the actual objects and some of them making artworks of them. But it was kind of winding down, and I didn't really know where what I was doing and how my work was going to change. And it was just this sort of crossroads. I had ended a long relationship, and I my dog had just died, and you know, all kinds of things were sort of stripping away. And so it was a kind of a helpful moment to go back to this place that had been very welcoming and supportive professionally and personally. And so I went back and was kind of amazed on one hand that so many people I knew were still there and were really thriving, and students I had taught are now kind of running the city and showing in, you know, great galleries in Kansas City, but also in New York and LA, and running institutions. And and so I got to go to different shows, and I, you know, was curated into exhibitions, and attended lectures, and got to see a lot of the new venues that have cropped up. And Kansas City really has developed. There's been a lot of new spaces. There's been also kind of a real estate boom, but it is still much more affordable, I think, than the East Coast.
Sure.
Or probably somewhere like Chicago in the Midwest. But the Kansas City magic continues.
I'm glad you were there and you're aware of that, because I sort of the main reason that I wanted to bring it back up and get a sense of where it is based, you know, since you were there many years ago, is I want you to try to sell it to people, you know, because again, going back to Michelle Grabner, you know, the conversations she's had with her students, like, where are you going to go? You know, you don't need to go to New York. You don't even need to go to LA, you know, et cetera.
Oh yeah.
It feels like if an artist, if a graduating grad student is open-minded enough, that they should be sold on Kansas City, you know? And so, why don't you see if you can do that? And the really tough sell, though, is for people who are already either in art centers or just on the coast, you know, because just as you have proven with your own life, you know, you're back on the coast, and I have lived on the coast, whether on the West Coast or the East Coast, my whole adult life. And it's a really tough sell to move inland, as it were.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. That is your sort of equilibrium.
Oh yeah. I mean, I remember hearing terms like flyover land and stuff like that, which, you know, I will say that when I lived there, there was this sense, you know, artists were often asked for art for auctions, and, you know, work wouldn't sell much for auction, and people would say, oh, well, yeah, there is a little collecting base here. People go to galleries, but they like to go to New York to buy their art because, you know, it's glamorous to go into a New York gallery and buy something. And that may still be true, but I know there are galleries like Ha, and like it used to be called the Dolphin, and now it's called Ha, and there's quite a few galleries there that actually sell a lot of work. So, but you know, I guess that's sort of a side issue, but I mean, not in many people's mind. But I guess, you know, the reason I would say one of the reasons that people do stay in Kansas City, like I remember I had students when I was teaching there who would actually go to New York and come back and say, yeah, when I was living in New York, I was living in Brooklyn or whatever sort of would be equivalent, like, I don't know, Long Island City, or even, you know, people are moving to like, you know, Norwalk, Connecticut, or Bridgeport, like, you know, as people keep moving further and further, Washington Heights, you know, Washington, maybe they were living in the equivalent of Washington Heights like 15 years ago, and still like saying, I'm still working 3 jobs to pay my rent, so I moved back to Kansas City so I can make art. But I also know a lot of artists in New York who make art. I mean, you do it and you find a way. And but I think a couple things. One is, I guess it's important to mention that there are these really generous organizations in Kansas City that I would love to see crop up. Like, I would love to see in Portland something akin to the Charlotte Street Foundation in Kansas City, which underwrote my residency when I went there. They have these residencies for artists, kind of like the Lower Manhattan residencies where, you know, you have a studio in a underused, you know, like office building or something. But they have a curator in residence. So they bring in a curator from another city, and that person does the rounds of Kansas City artist studios. And so they're very conscious of, and they give grants. When I lived there, I got one of their early grants, which is now up to $10,000. And they give you a show, and they give you, you know, a very nice amount of money. And so I had students who would stick around. When they saw that show of the grant recipients, they would say, I'm going to stay in Kansas City and get one of those grants. I remember Jamie Warren, who now lives in New York and was part of, helped found the amazing ensemble Whoop-Dee-Doo, but also has her own photography practice. I remember her saying that to me at the H&R Block space in Kansas City when that show was up, the Charlotte Street show. She's like, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to get one of those. And she did. And so very young artists, even coming fresh out of the school, were getting checks. At when I was there, I think it was $4,000. Now it's $10,000. And that's a very significant gesture of support in a young or even a mid-career artist's career. So that is an amazing thing that was started by an art lover named David Hughes, and we need more people like that who start those kinds of things. But
hang on a sec. How long do you need to be in residence in Kansas City to be eligible?
Well, they have residencies for people who live there, but I was the first. Well, they don't require actually that you live in Kansas City at all, but most of the residencies are solely a studio. I was the first kind of what they called a national studio resident, and there was a donor who underwrote my my living expenses when I was there. But generally, those residencies are for people who live there. But you could, I mean, I would advocate people. I think the deadline is in May. I would advocate for lots of people applying because you can find housing in Kansas City. You could go to YJ's Cafe and just go talk to David Ford, who runs that cafe, or go find Peregrine Honig, who got me my first apartment in Kansas City. Like there are people that people just say, hey, go find Peregrine, or go talk to Mo Dickens at the Belger, who's like, you know, he's now my collaborative partner and, you know, sort of one of my best friends and like a brother. And he would help any artist find affordable housing. If I said, hey, help out this person, which I had this student a few years ago who was a ceramics major and he wanted to do his junior year in Kansas City because they have great ceramics here, they have great ceramics there, and he knew about it. And I said to him, go find my friend Mo, and he will help you find housing. In fact, he might even put you up in his backyard. You know, it's sort of like this idea that, and, you know, not to be self-aggrandizing, it's not about me, but I was like, tell him Adrian sent you. Because, and you know, you probably could do that in other cities, right? I mean, it's sort of like how you use your network. And it's like, this is an extraordinary student, and he is, you know, could really be ignited by what is going on in Kansas City. This was somebody who was a musician. His name is John Slattery, and he was, you know, sort of notorious for, like, him and his band rehearsing in the bathroom at Mecca in the middle of the night, like, you know, in their whitey tighties, and, you know, trying to create a scene which was akin to that in Providence, which when he was growing up was happening around RISD and all those really cool kind of semi-abandoned spaces. So a lot of it goes back to real estate, right? And in Kansas City, there was and still is accessible real estate. You know, it was just exciting to me to try to send him. He didn't end up going, but I knew that there were people that, and actually anybody listening could go, literally, could go to the Belger Arts Center and go find Mo Dickens, and he will talk to you and have a conversation and try to connect with you. And, you know, this was what our project was about together, was trying to connect with people. And
I think that's a really... That's probably one of the best selling points, among several others. But I mean, I think as you're describing the, you know, go talk to Mo, go talk to Peregrine about finding a place or whatever, you know, that's the kind of thing that disappeared so many years ago in the art centers because it's too competitive and people are just like, you know, they don't want to give stuff away. I mean, there's definitely movements. And I can think of one person, Sharon Loudon, who has been advocating on the other side for inclusion and sharing. But I mean, it's so fragmented and so standoffish and, you know, and elitist. I mean, that's just the elitism in the art world is definitely perpetuated in the art centers, whether it's, you know, on a philosophical level or more specifically on a social level. You know, like, you can't join our club, you know, because that's inappropriate, or, you know, you need to work your way in or whatever, you know. So that, to me, is a really nice feature that you're describing.
Well, do you think that's actual, or do you think that's how it feels to someone coming from the outside? I mean, do you think
I think it's both. Yeah, I think it's both. There's, I mean, I've been in LA now for 15 years, and I still get that. So don't tell me that that's just a perception, you know. It's a reality.
Well, yes. Right. I mean, everybody's reality is a reality. And I think one of the things that drives me is seeking that out, or both to kind of create it and sort of, I'm very interested in reciprocity. And I think, you know, that's a sort of formalized way of saying, I think, things that I just do instinctively, which is both try to create opportunities for other people and then connect to other people from a very earnest place that sometimes lead to opportunities. I mean, my phone call with you today is coming out of such a thing. And so to just like show up and be present and be vulnerable and be willing to get past small talk with people quickly, or even never even, you know, enter into that realm, I think that that can lead to the kinds of things you're talking about. And I like the idea of like a new brand of entitlement, which isn't like about, you know, being famous or getting, I don't know, whatever the sort of currency is, but like to be able to access authentic experience. I think everybody wants that. Mm-hmm. And I think if, like, I recently, one of the things I was able to do, because I live here and I'm not teaching this semester, was I drove to New York somewhat unplanned fashion. I went to Marfa in October and I was able to learn a lot more about Donald Judd and kind of what he had, his vision of that community and how he influenced that and brought in artists and, you know, really, really impacted a place. And that is now drawing people. And then I found myself having conversations with people there. And then I picked up a flyer about some panels in New York at, you know, his old place, 101 Spring Street. And I think there was one at Cooper Union with Roberta Smith. And then there was one at a small bookstore in Chelsea with Rainer Judd, his daughter, and Flavin Judd was involved in the first two panels. And I just went. They were free and open to the public, and I was able to ask questions. And because a friend of mine from Kansas City went to school with Rainer, I just went up and talked to her and said hello, and we started having a conversation. But before that, you know, she was having this event at this small bookstore and was really interested in getting people both, you know, dialogue around the new book that they put out about their father's writing. But, you know, she's pretty pissed off about the pipeline, and she wanted to talk about that, and she wanted to organize. And there was this real, like, kind of sense of this continuation of the spirit of her father and public engagement and the artist as citizen. And I really felt that, and I felt like we were in this tiny little bookstore, and there was no hierarchy. Like, there was no, and I could, you know, people would come in, and she would say hello, and I'm sure they were famous artists I didn't recognize, but there was this sense of like insider. But then there was also like, I was sitting there in the front row and I could talk to her and then, you know, put something on Instagram and link it and sort of, I actually feel like I could start a conversation with these people because I've learned things. I don't know if I'm going too far afield here, but I like the sense of a kind of an entitlement to maybe ignore those kinds of hierarchies or those kinds of obstacles and just talk to people through engagement and passion and curiosity, right? And sort of like going to Donald Judd's library and then being able to, I mean, going to this big auditorium at Cooper Union, but they have a microphone. They're like, are there any questions? And so I went up and I asked a question. Like, and so, you know, that's one step, and then maybe you can talk to this person, and then maybe you can not treat people like they're not, like, what if we didn't treat people like they were inaccessible, even if they are famous, or even if, I don't know, and it's just something that came to my mind, because I did talk to this curator, or assistant curator who works at MoMA, who gave a talk at Marfa, and I heard her talk, and I went up to her after that talk, and we just started talking. And yeah. she was like, oh, so and you live in New York? And I'm like, no, I live in Maine, and I just drove down for this. And so, you know, but that comes from privilege, right? I mean, I have this teaching job, and I have a salary, and I have a car, and I can drive, and I have the money to put in my tank. But I think partly because of the election and all this, like I'm craving even more than usual connection and mm-hmm. authentic experience and mm-hmm. meaningful conversation. So I don't know. I think that if we pursue that instead of like, you know, if you approach someone through that, through a curiosity about their project, I can't help but wonder if maybe you can't pierce that, whether it's in New York or Portland, Maine, or Kansas City, or Marfa, or, you know, wherever you are. Maybe we don't have to heed those senses of like outsider, insider.
I hear what you're saying, and I think the most important point of what you're describing is you're sort of inadvertently pointing out or indirectly pointing out the baggage that we all bring, like I bring, you know, to perceiving certain situations. In other words, you may feel like intimidated or that you're not included or, you know, and you may bring that baggage to a given situation. I think, though, just to distinguish what you're describing, which is great, you know, that kind of going in, coming down from Maine, going in, having these conversations, is it's a more of a public kind of forum. You know what I mean? When you go to a
yeah.
talk, it's more inclusive and you're more encouraged to get into a dialogue even after, you know, the formal presentation as what sounded like the case for you. I guess I am thinking and sort of was referring more to studio visits, you know,
sure.
gatekeeping,
yes.
that kind of thing, which is
yeah.
not, which is a different scenario. That's kind of more what I'm talking
right.
about.
Right. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
I was just going to say, I mean, if you're looking for a show or a review
right.
or I wonder if the studio visit is a separate thing because, I think that that's a really reciprocal site. And I think, I mean, the curators I know or the, it just seems to me that people maybe are more accessible than we think, or people, if we approach it from like, I would like to share my work with you, and this idea, not that I'm looking for something, because I think maybe when we're in that stance, we approach things differently or we feel, I don't know, locked up. But if I'm seeing the whole thing as a conversation and this dialogue, like I'm engaged in this kind of part of this,
right.
this arm of the art world, and I'm making stuff, and I'm, you know, like I have my own thing, whatever it is, my idiosyncratic little world. And if I have enough, maybe this comes with experience, which is bringing people into the studio and having them get something.
Sure.
And tell you that maybe not, you know, maybe right then or maybe later, or maybe they send you a book reference or maybe, you know, to continue the conversation and to see it as connection and conversation and like an exchange of information. And so it's not like, you know, it's to know what you're doing in your studio and that it does have value and how, you know, if you have a few studio visits where people they're like, thank you, that was so interesting, and let's follow up. And you never know where opportunities come from, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of like you can't make them happen. And if you just talk to the right person or even if you get the right person in your studio, there's no guarantee. And I think it's much more alchemical than that. And it's like it's more synchronistic. And I'll just go back to Kansas City where, like, you know, I think Kansas City is like, you know, I feel like I'm surfing synchronicity when I'm there. Like when I need something, I reach my hand out and somehow like it just flies into my hand. Now I haven't felt that much that way as much in Portland, but I think actually, I mean, it's interesting because just talking to you, I'm realizing, you know, I was able to have studio visits with almost all the visiting artists, and Hrog Vartanian came in from Hyperallergic and I invited him to my studio and we had a conversation.
Right.
And that may be more that I'm getting more bold or, you know, it's just like I wasn't necessarily looking for anything, but I just offered it. Like, I would love to have a conversation with you. And I was lucky enough that he had the time and we did. And he gave me some really helpful, frank feedback.
This is during your residency in Kansas City, are you talking about?
No, sorry. This was in Portland last summer when I was teaching here in the
right.
MFA.
But what I guess I would say to that you were in an opportune location. Yeah. You were an opportune, you know, sight line yeah. for him. It wasn't like when Rog Vartanian was in Los Angeles and I were to just call, you know, tweet him randomly, hey, Rog, you want to come to my studio? You know what I mean? It was like he was right in your area, correct?
Yes. He yeah, was. Yeah. I'm curious, though. Have you tried that?
I haven't, but I should. I haven't, but I should.
well, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think he is someone. When he was here, he went up to the museum at Bowdoin. He was curious. He's like, what should I see? I think people want to know what's going on, and I think, I mean, mm-hmm. of course they're busy. And again, when he's in LA, he's going to be busier than when he's in
God,
Maine.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was, you know, he was working and editing, and he was probably close to just as busy, you know, being here because he's mobile. He can do things on his laptop, and he needs to be reading constantly and all that. So I did feel lucky that he came in, and it wasn't a very long visit, but I did get a lot out of it. And I think, I don't know. I mean, I think that it might be helpful for us to reach out even when we think the answer is no.
Right.
Just to get the data and see, okay, if it's not Twitter, is it something else? I mean, I don't know. It's interesting to maybe challenge assumptions and
Well, I think the important takeaway that I'm or the most interesting angle that I'm taking away from your sort of analysis of this whole scenario is to approach it as a conversation, as you said. So in other words, if your intention ultimately in getting somebody to your studio is the opportunity, like the possibility, you know, adding to your percentages of getting a show of some kind, that's not the most ideal place to come from. Whereas if you honestly are coming from a place of, I really just want to have a dialogue with this person and that's all I expect, you know, which is a really hard framework to, you know, maintain, to have that kind of very modest expectation, you know. But if you can do that, it seems like, you know, coming from that place, it's sort of much more purist and ultimately therefore less opportunistic, and you know, and plays out accordingly. You know, that's kind of how I read what you were describing.
Yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong. I mean, there wasn't part of me that would, you know, didn't have some fantasy that, you know, I was describing to him this project that I did with Mo Dickens in Kansas City called The Freeing Throwers, and there were these ads on buses with images and audio of Mo talking about giving up junk food and me taking a picture of him and the power of that picture and how he stopped eating fast food and all this. Like, it was, you know, it's a long story, and that project takes a lot of explaining. And so I was grateful to just have a chance to describe it to him, and I did show him some images, but it was really about telling a story. But, you know, and the project was up, and it was, you know, it was a public art project. I would love for someone to have written about it for Hyperallergic. I mean, that is a potential thing that could have come out of it. I mean, it wasn't something that was, like, outside of the realm of possibility, but there's so many. I mean, you're vying with everything and everyone, and me for him to know about that project, and I think you just never know when somebody says, oh, we're doing something about, you know, like, that was kind of came out of this collaboration I did unexpectedly with an evangelical Christian church in Prairie Village, Kansas. And, you know, sometimes people are looking for shows about spirituality or looking for, you know, art around these ideas. And, you know, it's helpful to just spread what you're doing, right? We all know that. But it is an interesting opportunity. I mean, goes to the crux of this project, which is about the sort of the contagion or the, like the power of suggestion. And I believe that these photos I've been taking of people letting go of things have a kind of, they're sort of impregnated with this energy of release that I think that when you see the image or maybe even only hear about the image, it might loosen something in us, or like something stuck that we need to let go of. And I think it's all very simple common sense. We all know that there's the power of role modeling and example setting, and, you know, that just, I say something and, oh, there's cheap housing in Kansas City. Like, somebody might get online and look at that. Like, that's how it works. So for me, I am genuinely as interested in seeing if I can just pass the energy along through, whether it's this, you know, art world, you know, literati person or another artist I know or a perfect stranger, or someone who might hear there was a radio piece on it. I'll take anybody passing on that energy of that project, but I also I do need, I think, to be sustained to continue my work. I need people to reflect back at me. And so I am asking, I think, for conversation and reception and being reflected back. And whether it's critique from someone who's informed and art school trained, or it's just, you know, a word or two tossed off, or somebody coming back as somebody did and say, you know, I told somebody about what Mo was doing with his food, and she cleared 5 truckloads of stuff out of her house, and now she's entertaining for the first time in years. And so we're told that this has like a tangible impact of even someone just telling someone about this project. And that, you know, it is always nice to, you know, to get reviews or get, you know, remuneration for your work. But what really sustains me is to know that it's meaningful and it's having an impact on other people. And that gives me the energy to keep doing the work, which my work is not very commercial, or hasn't. I haven't figured out the formula to sort of commodify it, although I make more work talking. I make more money talking about my work than I do selling it. I lecture a lot. I'm a visiting artist a lot, and I love doing that because it, you know, it's again, it's an opportunity to. It's like a mobile studio visit, right? It's like, hi, I'm here. Your teacher, for some reason, thought I was worth bringing in. Here's my work. Here's the backstory. I'm going to come into your studio, and then sometimes like continued relationships through those studio visits that have become friendships and really meaningful, you know, long-time connections, and people have sent me lists, and people, you know, have sent me photographs of them letting things go. And, like, there's this, you know, it is a correspondence and a kind of, you know, it's a conversation / correspondence, and it's nothing new. I mean, artists have been influencing each other and inspiring each other over the years, but it is harder maybe now to get access to someone who will sit for an hour, you know, and listen to your spiel, right? And look at your work, and that's a real gift. And yes, I'm being paid to give the lecture, but I'm giving all this energy out, and then, you know, so there's just this exchange. And I do think talking about one's work, showing one's work, making one's work, it's all transactional. It all puts energy out in the world, and it, you know, it's like it is this give and take. And I mean, that's why I'm particularly excited and grateful to be part of this, because I think, as you've shown, the conversation is so powerful and so, like, you never know where it's going to go, right? I mean, it's, you have to give yourself over to it.
Right. Well, maybe you can instruct me how to have remuneration for doing a conversation the way you do with your visiting artist things.
Let's brainstorm.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. But going back just a little bit to when you just said that you know, you haven't quite figured out the formula for making your work more marketable. It seems that you're kind of in an ideal scenario with being a professor and having that stable base and in addition doing the visiting artist gigs, and that gives you the freedom to make the work that you want and that does not depend on the market. So it seems that if you were actually to try to figure out a way to make your work marketable, that you would be sort of flipping that ideal equation that you have. Would you really want to endanger that that stability?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, and absolutely true. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would say no, because I get so much from the conversations I have with my students. They are really extraordinary and powerful, and I have grown a lot as an individual, and have watched them grow, and I think that, you know, it is a way I'm able to contribute, is through these sort of one-on-one, like, kind of pep talk, witnessing, encouraging, challenging. You know, it's all over the board. I mean, some people want to be challenged more than others, and some contexts afford me the chance to push people more than others. But actually, I mean, what I've kind of come to see is, I used to think it was my job to really push people out of their comfort zone. And I would get into, like, these frictional encounters sometimes with students, not a lot, but a few. And then I realized that I was like, you know, my job wasn't so much to push them out of their comfort zone, but to create an environment where they felt safe pushing themselves or leaping out of their comfort zone. And so I was able to kind of ratchet back that, not the rigor, but kind of like, oh, I see potential in you, and so I'm going to push you hard toward it. which is a little bit maybe arrogant or you know, it's like, well, potential is potential. It's not necessarily realizable either then or ever. And so if I can, I've just taken maybe a more gentle or kind of compassionate stance since I've realized that. Like, I don't have to force someone into realizing potential that I think I see in them. But you know, I admire people. Like, I have friends here in Maine, brilliant artists, Anna Hepler, Lauren Fensterstock, both of whom have given up full-time teaching jobs to be full-time artists. And they've both recently won $50,000 fellowships from the United States Artists. And I'm so happy for them. I will also say that I was also nominated and applied in earnest and did not get it. And I have to think, well, that's probably appropriate. You know, as you said, I am a teacher. I do spend a lot of time and energy on that, and I'm not doing this full time. So, maybe it just wasn't my year, but maybe right. It just makes sense for that. Those people who are taking that risk to be getting that kind of support.
What is the name of the grant?
It's called the United States Artists Fellowship.
United States Artists Fellowship. That's awfully generic sounding. And where is that based? Do you know?
You know, that's such a it is based in New York, and it's by
But it's for anybody
anonymous.
In the U.S.?
I think it is open. I'm not even sure if it's, yes, obviously, United States Artists. It is
right.
All over the U.S. I think that it's by anonymous nomination. Like, I don't know who nominated me.
Oh, you have to be nominated, like the
thank
MacArthur.
Thank you to
yeah.
the person, if you're
yeah,
listening.
Thank
but,
you.
yeah,
out yourself.
yeah, but it is an amazing thing, and that's, I mean, that's, so there's a great example, because you don't know who, you know, you never know what might happen. And so sharing your work with someone could lead someone to know about it, who then is asked for a list of nominees for something like that. And
right.
so, again, I mean, I think I do agree with you that it's more empowering and less demoralizing, and probably makes us less, I don't know, smarmy or whatever the right word is, like when you're approaching someone and you do have those kind of like opportunistic, you know, vibes.
Right. Well, I wanted to, before we run out of time, take a very general and philosophical approach to something that you already described a little bit that your work has been about, which is letting go. You know, and we could
sure.
sort of enumerate or name the various projects that you've done on the subject, but I think that's really beside the point. We can just say that, you know, you've done a lot of work about letting go, including quite literally these photographs of people throwing their, you know, stuff into these trash piles in Maine. But what I want, the way that I want to come at it is just hoarding and, you know, and letting go of our tendencies to hoard. Hoarding, obviously, is the sort of sensational version of it. But what I'm interested in to talk with you about is, I don't know if it's me and I'm sort of pushing this angle, but it seems like in some of our society there is a pretty steady movement towards downsizing and letting go. I mean, whether I'm using admittedly partially the frame of documentaries as, you know, as a guide, but for example, there's the whole slew of shows or documentaries that are about these tiny houses, right? But then there's also found on Amazon Prime the other day a documentary about minimalist living, you know, which was actually a European-based production. So what is, you know, what is your sense? Do you really feel like, and you've experienced this at all, you know, up in Maine or in Kansas City or wherever, New York, you know, that there is a direction in this way? Because, I mean, certainly materialism and consumerism marches on, albeit with, you know, a much more skeptical eye, you know. But anyway, take it where you will.
Yeah. Well, I think there is this zeitgeist, this letting go, scaling down, tiny houses, as you said. I read somewhere, and also that book, I think it's Marie Kondo.
The Marie Kondo,
power
sure.
of tidying.
Tidying, yeah,
right, where you're
absolutely.
Supposed to, like, hold the object towards your body and see if it brings you joy, and if
right.
not, let it go. And,
right.
And go through all your photos and take your books off the shelf. I would read this. My project with Mo Dickens started because I wanted to go hear a friend, who is a pastor and an artist, a pastor at this evangelical church, Dylan Mortimer, whose work is really amazing. I encourage everybody to look it up. I didn't have a car. My car had died. So they're like, and I didn't replace it, mostly because I didn't have the money to replace it. But in a certain sense, like, you know, I was going without, and I asked my friend Mo if he would give me a ride, and he reluctantly agreed. And I remember one day when we really started getting into this whole letting go thing, and we were just very, you know, we were just trying to explore it in all these different ways. I ordered that book, and I was reading passages to him as we were driving back and forth to church. And, you know, it's really interesting because it challenges all those notions like, you know, the bookshelf, right? The artist with the bookshelf and, you know, how, like, when was the last time we actually pulled that particular book off the shelf, and what is the power of having all these books? And, and she says, you know, like, oh, you have to take the books off the shelf and you can't do it by the spine. Like, she had all these actual strategies. And I think what I've seen happening is that there's always been the reality that people have to let go of things or want to let go of things. And I dealt with that really overtly. I had a show in Kansas City in 2010 at this really interesting gallery called the Kansas City Jewish Museum of Contemporary Art, which is now, I think, just called the Epstein Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at this Jewish retirement community and called Village Shalom. And there's death is happening there all the time. Maybe once a month, one of the residents dies, and people have to clear out their possessions. And so I think I've been studying this question about letting things go. I think even beyond, you know, before the quote unquote letting go project of photographing, but looking at people's to-do lists, which are so often like there's a purging aspect to it, like clear this out or get rid of this or go to the dump or take out the trash or do the recycling. Like there's this effort to get things out of our life and even get to-do list items off our list, right? There's this like desire to move things out of our space, but then we also have these attachments, emotional attachments and functional attachments. But I mean, obviously my mind's going a million directions. I could say lots of things about this, but you know, I think that might've been the first time, not the first time I was thinking about this. I think about this all the time. I have too much stuff. I have a storage unit. I come from, you know, parents who have a hard time letting things go. And, you know, it's definitely affected my life, and I'm interested in the tiny house movement, and I think that our digital devices are helping. Like, people don't have photos, boxes of photographs so much anymore, or we're not generating those.
Are you a do as I say, not as I do, but in regards to this
totally
collecting?
Totally. Well, you totally have my number. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, here's the difference between me and Marie Kondo, right?
Okay.
Marie Kondo lives in a place with, like, you know, five possessions, all of which bring her joy.
Right.
I am doing this project just as I did the to-do list project. Like, I'm not an organizing guru. I don't know how to get things done. I did that project where I collected lists because I was basically seeking mentorship from strangers and, you know, people I knew, but also strangers, and collecting all these lists to study them and see how do people spend their time and how do people get things done. And I think that what I'm doing now is, like, I had to let go of some things. They were voluntary and some things were taken away, and, you know, beings, and, like, I had a friend drown himself and then my dog died, and I applied for but didn't get promoted at work because I was dealing with all this loss and I wasn't on the top of my game, and I had to let go of this identity that, you know, of certain aspects of the way I thought I was performing as a teacher, and I was just like letting go, and then my dog died, and then I was at the dump without, you know, I told you the story last time about, like, you know, going to the dump thinking I was going to bring all these boxes with me, and I didn't bring them, and then I ended up there with nothing to do and just kind of noticing the mechanics of the recycling center and watching things fly through the air and, like, just kind of huffing that air of release and wanting it and needing it because I was going to do this residency and I needed to pack my stuff up, and it was completely overwhelming. And so I think that what I do through my work is I process the things I need to be doing, and it's sort of like, hey, folks, let's talk about letting go because I have a really hard time doing it.
Right.
And I think just watching culturally, I think some of you do too. And so it's a kind of collaborative effort, and I'm creating these opportunities for other people to let things go because I know the value of it. I have felt it, and I know the challenges of it. And so I'm glad this has come up, because I wanted to say something earlier around the teaching part, which is that, you know, I was taking these photographs of people letting go, and, you know, I don't know that they're necessarily interesting, but they do document this gesture, and there are some really beautiful kind of balletic gestures of these guys, you know, throwing shingles out of dump, you know, pickup trucks and
right.
throwing on the wood pile that are, you know, kind of funny and awkwardly elegant. There's something there. But I think what got more interesting was that when I started organizing these events where other people came to witness and encourage and even cheerlead. So I was saying, like, when I was doing this project at the church, I asked people to come outside to the dumpster, and if they wanted to let something go, they could do that either physically or symbolically. And then I asked some of the other parishioners to cheer them on. And so it's like this, you know, this my spiel was, you know, it's not just professional athletes who deserve cheerleading. We all deserve a cheerleading, especially when we're dealing with things that are difficult. And for a lot of us, letting something go because of what it represents, or because the person who gave it to us is gone, or because, you know, this relationship is ending and we didn't want it to, but, you know, whatever, or I'm not size 8 anymore, you know, like whatever the reality mm-hmm. is that's making it difficult to let go of the thing, it's helpful, I find, and that's kind of where my work is, like, the most, you know, where I'm citing myself right now is examining the power of witnessing, because what I've noticed is that when I admit myself to someone, mm-hmm. I'm having a hard time letting this go, or I'm having a hard time, I have a block with something, I kind of notice the next day, I do it. And so there's this acknowledgement or this identification that happens. And
right.
so you're like, yeah, as you said, many of us, you know, if you grow up in, you know, I have a friend from college who grew up in New York without a store, you know, without a basement and 5 bedrooms and an mm-hmm. attic and a garage mm-hmm. and, you know, like a parent who had a hard time letting go. Like, she doesn't keep stuff. That's not hard for her. And so some of it is contextual and some of it is personal. It's not, a lot of it is economic. But, you know, I had this great moment with this friend of mine, Mark, who I met at the church in Kansas City, because he tossed his iPhone, of all things, into the dumpster with the people cheering him on. And, you know, we had just spoken very briefly before this, but he told me that, and he wrote a statement, I don't think he would mind my telling this, it's on my website and it was on exhibition, that, you know, he described his mother as a hoarder and said, you know, he grew up around a lot of clutter and he created a lot of clutter and he tended to Facebook and text all the time, and his pregnant wife was trying to get his attention, and he felt, you know, he couldn't stop. And so he tossed the iPhone as this gesture that he wanted to have, you know, real one-on-one encounters instead of seeking this kind of false intimacy through his phone. And then people were cheering him on. And so he publicly sort of declared this intent. So for me, like, what I'm doing isn't just about stuff, but I think that when we let go of our emotional baggage, a lot of this physical stuff is a lot easier to let go of, because
right.
We're dealing with it. And so, you know, that was an important moment for me that encouraged me, because he turned to me after he tossed his phone and people cheered him on, and he said to me, "Your project could really help my marriage." You know, nobody had ever said anything like that to me before, and I thought, you know, wow, like, I'm, you know, I was sort of uncomfortable. I had never been too much to church at all. I had never been to an evangelical church. I didn't know if I would be welcome. I didn't know if I would hear, you know, homophobic rantings, which I didn't. I just heard these really lovely sermons about things like vulnerability and asking for help. And I kept going back and kind of opened myself up, and these people opened themselves up. And so what was interesting was, I just kind of, by identifying myself that way, people would tell me, like, I gave a lecture at the church at one night, and then the next Sunday I was back in church with Mo in the pew, and this woman tapped me on the shoulder, and she called me by name because she knew me from the lecture, and she said, you know, after your lecture, I went home and I went through all my bookshelves, and I have like 5 boxes of books in my car that I'm going to let go of. And then I went over to her, or no, she then sent me some photos. And so things like that started happening, where I realized I didn't have to take the photo. It was really about just that stuff was happening, and that maybe she would have cleared a bookshelf anyway, but it didn't seem like it would have happened right then. And then somebody else at the church worked at this organization that helped vocationally train adults with developmentally disabilities. And one of the things they did was recycle books. And so she ended up bringing the books there. and, you know, we arranged to take photos of her unloading the books. But, it, you know, it also, like, that part was a little bit forced and unnecessary. It really was just about the conversation of this woman tapping me in the pew and the fact that I was even in a pew at all. And so for me, I had to, like, I was letting go of my preconceived notions and some of my hang-ups.
Right.
And going to church and just seeing, well, what's here for me? Because, you know, I have a family member who's ill and might, you know, seemed in a very precarious situation. And I was kind of leveled and open to things that I hadn't been open to before. And those are moments, right, that we often let go of things, whether we want to or not. Like, you're moving, or you're foreclosed on, or your house is on fire, or you get some great opportunity to do a residence in Rome. And, you know, you just start going through your stuff. And so I'm interested in all of that. And I think, I don't know if I've answered your question at all, but I'll just pause for a second.
Thank you.
Let you talk.
Well, speaking of letting go of not just things, but perceptions, because that was the thing that you said earlier that I most wanted to revisit and ask you about is the quick passing moment when you said, regarding your applying for a promotion, I think, at work, essentially, you said, I had to let go of this idea that I would be moving up, something to that effect. Can you just elaborate on what, you know, that was about?
Oh, yeah, sure. That incredibly painful moment. Sure, let's go back to that. did I say that out loud?
You did.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well...
What happened?
I think... Well, I was, you know, I was up for promotion from associate to full professor, and I, you know, I'm an active artist, and I travel around, and I show my work, and I lecture about my work, and I'm, you know, I'm operating in the classroom, and I think, you know, students are giving me certain kinds of feedback, and I think that I'm, you know, quote unquote, doing a good job, and,
sure.
And having an impact, and watching my students grow, and getting letters back from them about, you know, things I've said to them, or ways, artists I've encouraged them to look at, or things I've encouraged them to read, which, you know, quote unquote, changed their life. And you have that kind of feedback. And I was invited, I think, the spring before to, you know, to address commencement, to be the graduation faculty speaker. So that was 1 year. And then the next year, you know, I went up for promotion, and I was told I was too professionally active and scattered in the classroom. And, you know, which I was, but I, you know, my brain is nonlinear, and I do sometimes, you know, if I set something out in the syllabus and then later I get a better idea, or somebody's making work that makes me, you know, change the assignment, I go with that flow. And I have always thought that that's been a good thing, and to be like responsive and nimble and fluid. And if my students are confused, maybe that's good, because it's art school and we should probably be confused for a while. And, but not everybody has the same perspective. And, you know, I had a sick family member, and I had a friend drown himself, and, you know, I was going through a divorce. Like, you know, it's just, of course, it wasn't the time to be applying for promotion. But,
right.
You know, going back to the earlier conversation, I was living on the west end of Portland and paying $1,350 for a one-bedroom apartment. And,
wow.
You know, just heat is expensive in Maine in the winter. And, you know, and also having a studio and buying materials and buying organic dog food, you know, making those kinds of decisions, of course, those are choices, but it was difficult, and I felt the need, you know, kind of an urgent need for more income. And so I felt like, you know, I went forward with this. I actually didn't know that it didn't really occur to me not to, but so I thought, based on my performance over the years, that that I would be promoted, and I wasn't. And I remember when I got the letter from the committee, I literally, like, you know, there's that whole thing of, like, there's that cliche, or just that expression, I was shaken up. I literally felt, I mean, I don't know if it, I felt literal. I remember holding the edge of the table. I had just taught a intro to digital imaging class, and I was still sitting at the computer, at the instructor computer, and everybody in the class had filed out, and I opened my email, and I got this letter, and I felt myself shaking, not trembling, but like there was an earthquake. And I remember gripping the table, and just like, it just wasn't what I was expecting. And I'd been, you know, I was like thinking, oh, when I get my raise, I'll be able to pay this off. I'll be able to pay this off. I'll be able to do this and this and this. And And it's like that whole, all those things, all those plans or all those quote unquote expectations just kind of fell out from under me. Plus, you know, these ideas of, you know, the esteem of one's colleagues or this and that. And just thinking, well, I thought it was a good thing to have these visiting artist gigs and go around and learn about grad programs, which I've then recommended to students who have then gone there. And, you know, those things are all true. And then there are also things like attending committee meetings and, you know, going to open houses and representing the college that, you know, it's like they're just these things that maybe, like boxes that weren't being checked because I was, you know, where I was. And I just had to sit there. I had to sit with it and say, like, okay, well, I mean, I'm sort of speechless because I was speechless. And, you know, it's just that moment. It's like, well, I'm still an artist and I'm still a teacher and I think I still have a job. But it was very, and also, you know, just this was a period where I was, I had moved like 7 or 8 times in that course of, you know, 2.5 years. And I had a lot of change and I just, you know, sort of like life, my perception of where I was kind of catching up to where I actually was. And, you know, it's not like nobody died, but it was very challenging for me and humbling. Like, I want to say humiliating, but I think, you know, it went from being humiliating to humbling. But I literally, I just remember, like, gripping the table because I felt like the room was spinning because, you know, I gave up this great job in Kansas City and this life in Kansas City, and I'd come to Maine, and you know, it just felt like, you know, my marriage ended, and it just, there was just a lot of loss. And so sort of like gripping onto this job, like, oh, okay. So it was like, you know, it was an eye-opening experience. Now the gift of it was that a week later I got a couple months later I got this residency. I guess I got the invitation a week after my dog died to go to Kansas City. And so the timeline's a little confused, but I, you know, if I hadn't had that humbling experience with the job situation, I don't think I would have sought out that residency, which yielded so much richness in terms of my project and like personal and professional. And I was able to come back in a different configuration, that one that is probably better suited to me and that allows me to spend more time one-on-one with students and work more in the grad program. And so it was like these things that kind of fell away. I didn't want to give them up because there was some fear, but I found over and over that fear is not a good motivator. And that if I can, I need to pry my hands, my death grip off things that I'm holding on to because of fear. But, you know, it's hard to do that when you're going through, you know, what feels like a personal forest fire.
Mm. Well, forest fire, I think that I can't imagine a better vision to wrap up on, can you?
Oh,
well, maybe.
Yeah,
but,
right. Well, the image of the tiny sapling, you know, rising
right
through this,
well,
smoking,
I was,
forest.
I was thinking more actually of your sort of prior to the forest fire mention, coming to terms very nicely, very thoughtfully with your going from feeling incredibly humbled to and humiliated before that to having this great opportunity. And, you know, and that turnaround is a nice thing to recognize and let go of that that table that you were holding on to presumably so hard.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I mean, I think just like over the years my view of teaching has shifted. And I, you know, I used to go into students' studios for, you know, for studio visits and feel like and sometimes they would go on and on because I felt like I couldn't leave until I'd imparted some wisdom or said something important and you know, significant and helpful. And then I realized, you know, other people would be like, well, I'm doing a 30-minute studio visit. And I'd think, 30 minutes? Like, well, I don't know that I can change someone's life in 30 minutes. But so then I started just setting the alarm on my phone, right?
Right.
And and then when the buzzer went off, I learned to say thank you. Mm. And so the paradigm shifted from this feeling or this assumption that I was supposed to, like, you know, give them something or change them or, you know, have this whatever, brilliant insight that was supposed to come from me, as opposed to, okay, here's an opportunity. I'm here. I'm paying attention to you. I'm going to absorb and witness, and I might have something to say today, or it might be next time, or it might be in 5 years. And so if it goes to back to that model of reciprocity where I, you know, I'll say, oh, the buzzer's up. Thank you so much for sharing your work. And hopefully I had said something helpful or insightful or shared some, you know, something, or asked them a question or whatever, or even just having the opportunity to put their work up in a thoughtful, conscious way was, you know, was generative in some way. But, you know, so it was helpful to kind of shift that, you know, that idea about what does it mean to be a teacher, or that, you know, I need to be so embarrassed that I didn't get a promotion that I would never in a million years mention that in an interview. And you know, but it isn't the most comfortable thing, and it is a little bit vulnerable to say it to you and much less to other people listening. But I think the gift part will come when other people listen and maybe then email me or share with me, oh, I had a similar experience, which has happened to me. Mm. Those kinds of things where I realize, oh, not everybody gets a promotion on the first go, or, you know, someone will say, oh, my student evaluations were terrible and I had to really work on this, or I had to help the school acknowledge that there is a there sometimes are gender differences in the way students evaluate, you know, faculty who present with different genders. And, you know, like there's just everything goes into the pot. And if I'm really in this to be growing and conscious and a student myself, then yeah, I'm grateful for that experience because I have grown and I have gotten better both as a teacher and a human and an artist as a result of that experience. But it was really hard and painful.
Well, if you have provoked listeners to write in, you will have done quite a job, because it is challenging to get feedback on this podcast, believe it or not. But in any case, Adrienne, thank you. Thank you very much for talking.
Thank you so much for listening and talking. And I let's cross our fingers that we get some conversation
fingers,
going.
Fingers are totally crossed. And we're out. Thank you so much again to Adrienne. I hope you guys found that conversation and what she had to say enlightening. I hope you got that 100% plus that she gives in her studio visits. And fingers are crossed. Hope to hear from you guys. And just to add to what she essentially implied, she is open to having a dialogue with any of you about her work in particular, but I think her experience in general as well. So feel free to reach out to her directly or via me. Better yet, maybe you can put it on social media, that kind of thing. That'd be awesome. So thank you again to Adrienne. Thank you to you guys for listening. There are a couple more things before we go. Bad advice is coming up. And before we get there, though, I did want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show, The Conversation Pod. And donations and other support is very much appreciated. Before I dive into that spiel, let me just say thank you to those of you who have donated recently. Big thanks to David Rufo, who gave me a little holiday donation and has been a rock solid foundation of support for this show, both, you know, by donating several times, but also for giving shout outs on social media. So I really appreciate that kind of support. I've also gotten some support from Australian listeners, which I really appreciate. Australia seems to be well known for a culture that is steeped in podcast support, based on one of the other podcasts that I listen to. So thank you guys as well. And again, if you would like to support the show financially, we would be more than happy to include you, get you the bonus footage. That includes the one with Max Maslansky, an outtake with Matt Gleason from the two-part episode. And I'm going to put out a new one fairly soon, as in addition to those, that is with an unreleased guest. So that's kind of a surprise for donating members of $20 or more. And you can do that by going to theconversationpod.com/support. And it would be very much appreciated. You can also support the show, of course, by sharing your thoughts, leaving a very nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the website, and of course, following on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and becoming a fan on Facebook. Always happy to hear from you. I'm great at responding, in case you didn't know that because you're shy or whatever. Let's get to some bad advice before we hit the holidays, provided by Kate Mitchell, and she did an awesome job curating this week. First one is, art school had taught me it was far better to be a flamboyant failure than any kind of benign success. Malcolm McLaren. Even if you don't have all the things you want, be grateful for the things you don't have that you don't want. That's from Bob Dylan's dad. Wow. And speaking of Bob Dylan, sometimes you just have to bite your upper lip and put sunglasses on. That's from Bob Dylan Chronicles, Volume 1. And finally, to take you through the holidays, save the best for last, as you know. Before you criticize someone, walk a mile in their shoes. That way you'll be a mile from them and you'll have their shoes. Anonymous. Yes. Yes. That is what I'm talking about. Right? All right. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got a lot out of that episode. I hope you are staying warm if you are in the States. I hope you are staying cool if you are in the Southern Hemisphere. And one other update before we go, actually, a couple other updates. One is that, if you're still on, thank you for being here. I am still looking for people to help out on the new podcast that I'm working on called How I Get By, which is conversations about half hour or less with a wide demographic of people who are basically getting by in very creative ways. They can be, you know, stringing together a few different part-time or freelance gigs. They can be doing something very unusual, but, you know, they're just kind of getting by financially with that gig. They're not comfortable, but they're okay with it. They're okay with their situation. So I need help. I've got it. Tim is helping me with coming up with a theme song for the show. I would love any help that you might be able to offer for a logo, and even more, if you would be interested in helping on a production level, and that includes helping to find guests, screening them, and so on. I would love to have you. All right. That's it for now. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.